People are staying home to keep ourselves and each other safe, but what if home isn't safe at all?
In fact, I had a woman at a shelter in San Francisco say, you know, even if we're out of space, we will give them our office to sleep in. We will turn nobody away.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Monday, April 13th, reaching out to victims of intimate partner violence and child abuse during a pandemic. Also on the show, what we know about recovering from COVID-19 and what happens next, and how restrictions on who can donate blood may be preventing us from saving current and future patients.
I'm sitting in my apartment with this army of antibodies. They just happen to be a gay army of antibodies, and they're not getting put to any use.
Plus, comedian Aparna Nancherla on what it's like to be an anxious person in a time of extreme anxiety. While essential workers risk their lives to bring medical care to those in need and to keep grocery stores stocked for everyone, a lot of us have been staying inside for weeks now to help stop the spread of COVID-19. That's important for public health, but for some people, that's keeping them closer to dangerous situations and further from help and resources. This is especially true for victims of domestic violence and child abuse. For many, support systems and resources that might normally be available are overwhelmed or are even more difficult to access now. And around the world, many governments and organizations are looking for solutions to protect vulnerable people unsafe in their own homes. Some women's shelters, for example, have found ways to stay open. Beth Sturman, the CEO of Laurel House, a domestic violence agency in Montgomery, Pennsylvania, says their shelters have been able to find alternative housing options, like hotels, for victims of domestic violence.
Anyone who calls who needs shelter related to domestic abuse and safety, we will be able to take care of. We have not had to turn anyone away.
So now I'm joined by two people to talk about why this moment is especially dangerous for some and the efforts worldwide to find solutions. Rachel Louise Snyder is the author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. And Nadare Salim is the CEO of the Children's Network of Southwest Florida. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Hello.
Rachel, I want to start with you. What has changed for survivors of domestic violence right now versus before this disease?
The biggest thing is that, you know, everybody is stuck inside. And so whatever stressors existed before COVID-19 are exacerbated right now. You might have financial pressures. You might have, pressures from your children being home at school. And so all those things are just sort of exacerbated. But you couple that with the fact that you cannot access resources. It's very difficult to do a safety plan when you can't leave your house, when you can't talk on the phone freely to someone who could help you form a safety plan, or when police won't enter your house to try to collect evidence, for example, if there is an incident. So there's just all kinds of pressures from all different places coming at people in this situation right now.
Nadare, have you seen an increase in reported incidents of child abuse in South Florida, where you're based, since the coronavirus outbreak began?
What we're actually seeing is an increase in the incidents and the maltreatments of domestic violence, alcohol abuse, and other substances in Southwest Florida.
And what are the main factors behind that? I mean, are they similar to what Rachel mentioned, people being cooped up inside?
Yes. And in addition, you know, our children are even further isolated since they're not in school. There are no after school programs. Their extended family is limited in their ability to visit. So the visibility increases vulnerability for our children. So limited visibility equals to increased vulnerability.
Rachel, when this pandemic first started, there was some fear that shelters wouldn't be able to stay open. Are we seeing that happen?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that, because I've seen that reported in some media, but I actually I've interviewed more than 36 people in the last 10 days or so, 2 weeks, and I have yet to come across any shelters that have had to close. Many of them have had to adapt, and as the woman from Laurel House said, lots of shelters are working with hotels to try to house not just victims or survivors of domestic violence, but also, you know, first responders or homeless people from the homeless population. So hotels are being called to work in the front lines, I guess, in that way. But also shelters have had to vastly adapt, right? You're talking about people living in communal housing who now have to isolate. And for children, that is incredibly difficult. You know, children are natural communal populations.
Yeah.
And so it's been very, very difficult for people, but just as the woman from Laurel House said, nobody is turning anyone away. In fact, I had a woman at a shelter in San Francisco say, you know, even if we're out of space, we will give them our office to sleep in. We will turn nobody away. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm finding more than shelters closing.
The French government has provided housing for some victims of domestic violence, and it seems like some states and organizations here in the U.S. are trying to do similar things. You mentioned talking to an organization. Do we know how well that's working?
Well, yeah, the French government contracted to rent hotel rooms for victims of domestic violence. That's something that we've always done here. I mean, that's long been a practice in Washington, D.C., for example, where I live. That's a very common thing to do. The difference is that we don't do it through our federal government, right? Our federal government really offers very few protections. So I'm seeing it in places. Chicago has done it. San Francisco is doing it. D.C. I'm seeing it, but it's through organizations and organizations which are really, really struggling financially right now. So they're putting themselves out in the hopes that funding will catch up with them in the future, in the near future. It's a kind of terrifying position to be in.
Nadara, you mentioned, you know, obviously kids out of school where they would come in contact with a mandatory reporter like a teacher or an administrator. Is it becoming harder to know if children are in an abusive or neglectful situation, given kids out of school and kind of limited visits between other people who might be able to speak up on their behalf?
Yes, we're quite concerned about that. Actually, we're seeing the numbers of abuse reports have gone down across the state of Florida. But one effort we're making is for the children that are known to us, whether in our prevention programs, diversion, or in-home services or foster care, we have increased the frequency of our contacts. So prior to this, we would be visiting the children once every 30 days. Now we're trying to have contact with them once a week or once every 2 weeks, so that at least we have increased our eyes on the kids as one measure of protection. But yeah, we're quite concerned that maybe after this, we might have a surge in the number of reports just to make up for the lost time and the fact that our kids are not visible to the community at large.
That's so important what you said. And I want to just add that domestic violence victims will often stay in a situation until the children are hurt, right? It's when their children are threatened that makes them finally flee. You see that in cases over and over. And I just want to underscore what she said, because it's so important, because children are really stuck, which means domestic violence victims are really stuck today. And when I talk to shelter workers or advocates or police officers, they're seeing the same thing, that calls are going down, but the extreme severity when they do finally get calls is going up. And so there's this disconnect between what appears to be happening, but what that actually means for our first responders.
Well, let's talk about kind of the options that people have then. I mean, I'm curious, Nadare, is it harder to place kids into different housing or move them out of a dangerous situation right now?
So, you know, as part of our preparation for this, we quickly got an inventory of all of our foster homes that had available beds or capacity. And we inquired, would you be willing to take new children or children who possibly have tested positive or come in contact with anyone? We did the same thing with our group homes, with our families who are relative caregivers, to try to increase the capacity. And so we kind of went into this with a little bit of a preparation in, you know, just in case we had a surge of kids coming into care. So far, you know, some areas of the state are struggling because if the children test positive or we have large sibling groups, it makes it difficult to place because families aren't sure, well, have these kids been exposed? You know, how do we know? And we can't quite quarantine every child that comes into care. We take all the precautionary measures that CDC and the Department of Health gives us. So we have not hit the crisis yet. But I'll tell you one area that we're struggling with are the older youths who have a tendency to either run away or have some behavioral problems and DJJ challenges. So that group is posing quite a challenge for us. So we're doing the best we can, and we're partnering with our faith community. The churches have really opened up their arms to us. So between all of us coming together, the nonprofits, government, and the faith organization, so far we've been able to manage. And we're always calling out for new foster parents to join us.
Well, Rachel, you mentioned people being able to reach out and, you know, the idea that it's not as easy to make that phone call right now or to reach a hotline. What are you seeing in terms of both how kind of response groups and hotlines are adapting, but also whether technology, you know, is able to play a role here when it's more difficult to make that call?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I am seeing that response line advocates are having to adapt their language. So calls take a lot longer because they can only ask yes or no questions. Are you safe? Can you get out of the house right now? Things like that. And they troubleshoot, like, can you say that you've got a piece of mail to deliver for the neighbor that got delivered wrong, like something to buy them 5 minutes to go outside so that they can do just a tiny bit of safety planning. So that's one thing. Technology is certainly a help. There's a lot of apps out there that are geared toward different populations. I would recommend Yardley Love's mother. Yardley Love was the killed by the lacrosse player in Virginia, University of Virginia. The One Love Foundation has a lot of great resources and lots of different apps that they recommend on their website, but there's one in particular called My Plan, and it's all lowercase with a capital P, My Plan, because there's a lot of different My Plan apps, as it turns out, health and fitness and stuff. So it's that capital P that matters. And that helps victims to assess their own safety. But the other thing that I'm hearing people doing is to have a very small group of girlfriends or family members that you can reach out to and have a code word. Maybe you want to talk about your grandmother's cake, and when you mention the type of cake, it's a code to call 911. Or, you know, talk about your pet. Have some sort of work out some sort of language so that you can reach out safely for help. It's just a very scary time in which we really don't know what the outcome is going to look like.
Rachel and Nadare, thank you both so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Louise Snyder is the author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. And Nadare Salim is the CEO of the Children's Network of Southwest Florida. Stay with us. This is The Takeaway. As thousands of people around the world continue to get sick from the coronavirus, many are also recovering. According to data from Johns Hopkins, more than 200,000 people worldwide have recovered from the virus. That number will keep climbing, since experts have said around 80% of those who contract the disease go on to recover. And as we learn more about asymptomatic carriers, that number could end up being even higher. But there are still a lot of unknowns about recovery from the disease, including how long someone can continue to spread the virus once they're feeling better, and whether people are immune once they've recovered, and for how long. So we're going to talk about it with Joel Achenbach, who is a science writer for The Washington Post, who has been writing about the coronavirus since January, and Kamal Khanna, an immunologist and associate professor in the Department of Microbiology at the NYU Langone Medical School. Thank you so much to both of you for being here.
So thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure.
Joel, you wrote about people who've recovered from COVID-19. How much data do we have about who they are and, I guess, how large a population we're talking about here?
Well, this is all new, obviously. And so every story we do has these caveats that this is preliminary. But, you know, most people do recover over the course of a couple of weeks. It's a pretty brutal couple weeks they endure, but then they're better. And what we found when we talk to people is just a lot of uncertainty about exactly where they stand with the virus. So if you go to the CDC website, what they say is if you hadn't had a fever for 3 days without using fever-reducing medication, and if it's been at least 7 days since the start of your symptoms, and you've had improvement in your respiratory symptoms, that you don't have to self-isolate anymore, i.e. you probably are not still infectious. But a lot of people we talk to, you know, they worry about it. They worry about going back out there. There's some stigma involved of having it. And then there's the question that you brought up, which is, are they immune from getting the virus a second time? And we don't know, but probably they are. That would be the default assumption, but that's not established scientifically.
Kamal, what do we know about how the immune system factors into all of this right now, given that it is still so early?
Indeed, as Joel mentioned, it is all very new. The biggest thing that we have to worry about, or the biggest thing that factors into all this, is what you may have heard of neutralizing antibodies. So are there neutralizing antibodies that are being formed, and how robust they are? And also, the key here is how long do these neutralizing antibodies last? And when I say neutralizing antibodies, these are these antibodies that are made in your body after an infection that can then essentially decorate the virus if you get a reinfection, and will prevent it from binding to its receptors and gaining access to the cells in your lungs where this virus infects. So this is very early. There's a study that just came out, and a lot of these studies, again, I will put a caveat to these, are not peer-reviewed yet. And so you have to take that with a grain of salt. But early indication, at least with the SARS-CoV-2, is that there is a robust antibody production, and that probably depends on how strong the infection was. So in elderly, where the infection seems to be severe, you actually have a lot more antibodies that are being recovered. In milder symptoms, people who are asymptomatic, there's a thought that maybe antibody production is actually low because the infection never really proceeds to a point where your, you know, the robust immune system that's needed to produce the antibodies never really gets going because you're asymptomatic. So now the point is, how long will these antibodies last? So how do we know this? We have to think about what we know about what happened with SARS-1 and MERS, which were the first two coronavirus outbreaks. But the data there is that with SARS-1 and MERS, they were able to find antibodies that were protective, that considered protective, up to a year or two. Now, here, what we have to do is essentially follow all these patients and see how long these antibodies last. So considering that there are antibodies, I think people will most likely be protected either completely or at least partially for hopefully at least a year or two if this follows what happens with SARS-1 and MERS.
Joel, when you talk to people who are in the process of recovering or have recovered from COVID, was there variance in terms of how they're feeling now based on how sick they were? I'm thinking about this idea that Kamal said, which is, you know, maybe antibody protection might vary on kind of the strength and vehemence of their infection.
Well, that's a fascinating point that I had not heard before. And Dr. Khanna, thanks for sharing that. And I have also seen one study out of the 2003 SARS outbreak that it showed the antibodies were steady for about 2 years, and then the third year they declined. Mm-hmm. And this is a different virus, but it's related, so you could imagine it might be similar. I've heard it's speculated that kind of like that eventually this coronavirus will be more like a cold over the course of many years as it circulates through the human species. But anyway, yeah, some people still have a little hacking cough. They still feel tired. They still feel beat up by it. And others are totally fine. It just varies from person to person. And why it varies, I mean, there's another, you know, million-dollar question. And why is it that some people get hammered, so it kills some people, and others just shrug it off? We don't know.
Yeah.
Well, Kamal, I guess I'd like to sort of ask you this question of whether plasma therapy, which I know many hospitals are working on, is something that could be used to treat patients as we go forward.
Yeah, I think it's very early, but there's been some papers that have come out with just very small patient samples. Like there was a study with just 5 patients and it helped almost all of them. I mean, right now they're only trying this with severely ill patients, and that's how it should be. So plasma therapy has worked in the past. I think one thing that I would add when we were talking about the antibody issue, you may have heard of this this concept called immune enhancement. Sometimes what happens is that the antibody can actually cause damage because it can actually redirect the virus into cells that it normally doesn't infect. And that has been reported with some of the other SARS virus, the SARS-1 or MERS actually. So those are some of the things that a lot of people are considering when they're doing the plasma therapy, because it's early in the stage, but it is something very promising.
Kamal Khanna is an immunologist and associate professor in the Department of Microbiology at the NYU Langone Medical School. And Joel Achenbach is a science writer for The Washington Post. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
You.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Earlier this month, the Food and Drug Administration reduced the amount of time men have to wait to donate blood after having sex with another man. Prior to this, the policy said men had to wait at least a year before they could donate. Now, the waiting period has been reduced to 3 months. That decision came after a dramatic drop in blood supply across the U.S., as many churches, schools, and other venues canceled blood drives due to COVID-19. But as this pandemic rages, the need for blood hasn't diminished, and not just because there's need for plasma donations to try to treat COVID-19. There are still victims of car accidents, gun violence, and cancer patients, all of whom still need blood donations at this time. In Michigan, the TV station WDIV Detroit reports that the shortage in donations is causing major problems for hospitals.
The email from Michigan Medicine echoes what every hospital is dealing with across the state. I am standing in the blood bank at Michigan Medicine, it starts, in Ann Arbor. I am looking at the refrigerator that contains only one day's supply of blood for the hospital. The hospital is full. There are patients who need blood and cannot wait.
So now that the rule has changed, we wanted to revisit how this policy has affected our past. We asked you how these regulations have affected you at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
This is Jonathan Nichols from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and I believe that this is one of the worst policies to ever be put in place by the FDA. It greatly offends me, and I have personally been denied the right to donate, and it was an awful experience. It just makes you feel like less of a human than everyone else just trying to save lives.
My name is John. I'm from Miami, Florida, and as a bisexual man, I've had a couple different experiences with donating blood, but recently I've just started lying on the questionnaires. I learned that they have to test all the blood regardless of who it comes from for HIV and other diseases commonly sexually transmitted. So it seems like a stupid rule to discriminate against a group of people.
My name is Dallas. I live in Dallas, Texas, and I work for a large company that often has charitable events, including blood drives, and I always avoid the topic at work because people either don't know that I'm gay or they don't know about the restrictions, and it always leads to an awkward conversation. So now every time that happens, I just avoid the topic of the blood drive entirely.
Hey, this is Amy in Morristown, and you know, I have trouble giving blood because one of the questions is, have you ever had a boyfriend who turned out to be bisexual? And in fact, I did a long time ago have a boyfriend who was bisexual. When I found this out, it was still during the AIDS crisis, and I was just like stunned and furious because obviously you can just wait. You can test the blood. There's so many other things that are also bloodborne that don't stop you from giving blood. So it's a ludicrous, ridiculous barrier in the first place.
Some of our listeners, like Angus Cosgrove from New York, don't think the new relaxed FDA restrictions go far enough.
The blood, which was unacceptable just weeks ago, is exactly the same blood which flows through my veins today. And that just makes me feel like a second-class citizen in the eyes of the law. After this is over, will my blood suddenly be inferior again?
This is Matthew from Seattle. I think it's ridiculously discriminatory to restrict men who have sex with men from donating blood. I work in HIV research, and the notion that we are still focused on MSM as the primary carriers of HIV is dangerously outdated, as it ignores true risk that any sexually active person faces, and that's actually along with many other methods of transmission. If we are really in need of blood, as we are, it's unconscionable to arbitrarily restrict large groups of the population from donating.
To learn more about the history of these restrictions and the effect they're still having today, I spoke with Alfonso David, president of the Human Rights Campaign, and James West, deputy editor of digital with Mother Jones Magazine. James recovered from COVID-19 and wrote about how, because he's gay, he was unable to donate blood, which contains plasma that might help researchers find a cure for COVID-19. I first asked Alfonso how these restrictions came about and how he feels about this latest policy change.
In the 1980s, during the HIV/AIDS epidemic, there was a high prevalence of the virus among men who have sex with men, and there was no reliable test for the virus. Accordingly, the Federal Drug Administration justified a blanket ban on blood donations for men who have sex with men. And that ban was implemented in 1983. That ban was not changed until 2015, at which point the FDA changed their policy from having a blanket ban to change it to 12 months, so that a man who have sex with a man could not give blood for 12 months after the last sexual contact. And the FDA justified the change by suggesting that it was to better align the deferral period with other increased risk factors and what other countries were doing. And they also looked at a number of different studies to determine that this was the most appropriate policy. As of last week, the FDA yet again changed their policy from 12 months to now 3 months, suggesting that men who have sex with men are prohibited from donating blood if they have sex within the three-month period. They have to effectively be abstinent for 3 months or wait for 3 months after the last sexual contact. It effectively targets LGBTQ people, and specifically gay men and bisexual men, from donating blood simply based on their identity and is not focused on risk factors.
James, you had COVID-19, you recovered from it, and you wanted to donate your plasma for some sort of frontline therapies, but couldn't. Tell me a little bit about that experience and why you wanted to donate your plasma in the first place.
Yeah, this whole thing got really personal for me because as my head was pounding and my throat was sore and I was coughing during the worst of it, one of the things that allowed me to have a little bit of hope was the idea that my plasma, which is inside my blood, which has potentially some COVID-kicking antibodies in there, could potentially be given to other patients in far worse situations than me in new trials called convalescent plasma trials. Now, this is just getting started. They're looking for donors. And so, you know, of course, I wanted to help. I wanted to put this very bad experience to some good news. And that's where I ran up against this roadblock, which I have before because I've always wanted to give blood, but never been able to. And then this came along, and of course, the people doing the collecting have to abide by the FDA rules, obviously. And so that's where it got really personal to me. And I just really wanted a way to, you know, I'm sitting in my apartment with this army of antibodies. They just happen to be a gay army of antibodies, and they're not getting put to any use now that I've recovered.
What was that like? I mean, that must have been just incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, it kind of sucked, to be honest, because, you know, this is where the rubber hits the road, right? There's a blood shortage, but there's also these other potential promising treatments. Of course, the scientists say that a lot still needs to be known, but I would love to be part of that solution, and right now I can't.
When we think about how the policy has affected the medical community over time, and even during this pandemic, do we know kind of what it has done in terms of limiting available blood supply for hospitals, donation centers, et cetera?
the Williams Institute conducted a study estimating that the 13 million LGBTQ people who live in the United States, 42% of the population identify as male. That's approximately 5.46 million gay, bisexual, and trans men who are precluded from giving blood and have to wait for 3 months. Now, another interesting statistic. In the United States, 8.5% of men, which is about 10 million men, say that they have had sex with a male partner since they were 18. And 4.1% of men, which is about 4 million, say that they've had a male sex partner in the last 5 years. Another 4 million reported having a male sex partner in the last 12 months. So what we're effectively doing is precluding between 5 million and 10 million men from donating blood during the worst pandemic that this country has seen.
James, as part of your reporting on this, you spoke to the Red Cross, which is one of the organizations dealing with the shortage in blood donors. What did they tell you about donating blood?
Basically, they're in the tank for changing this policy. They want to see more advocacy to close down this gap, to make sure that the LGBTQ community are more involved in blood donations in general. But my understanding is they don't go as far as Alfonso is advocating there, to get rid of basically basing this whole thing on identity and moving more to risk factors, like what kinds of sex that you have.
Well, Alfonso, let's talk about the science a little bit, because as you mentioned, this comes from the early days of the AIDS epidemic. Is there any medical reason, essentially, for these guidelines to still be what they are? Or do we know so much more now about HIV transmission that it's just kind of a misconception?
It's a misconception. I think this policy is rooted in bias and is a vestige of the past. Every single donor is screened for risk of transmissible disease by questionnaire, and each unit of blood that is donated in this country is routinely screened for various infectious disease pathogens, and that includes syphilis, hepatitis, the West Nile virus, Zika virus, HIV, bacterial contamination. So we already test our blood, the blood that is donated, to determine whether or not it has various infectious disease pathogens. Now, we recognize that there's a latency period in which some of these pathogens may have to be tested again. But the bottom line is there is no reason to effectively exclude men who have sex with men from donating blood, because we have the science to determine whether or not the blood is actually contaminated. And also another important point, there is no deferral period in many countries around this world. Argentina, Chile, Colombia, Italy, Mexico, Russia, South Africa, Spain, there are no deferral period. Individuals can donate blood in those countries. There is no reason why in this country we are not being driven by science, and instead we have a policy that is essentially rooted in bias.
Alfonso, one of the things that I'm struck by here is where we are in 2020 versus 1983. We have PrEP now. We have therapies for HIV. There are all sorts of things, even just asking someone about their sexual history, that could help lower risk. Are those things under discussion in terms of trying to, as you say, create a risk-based profile for donors, as opposed to one that just says, well, this is who you are?
Yes, those issues are being discussed. In fact, the Human Rights Campaign met with the American Red Cross, one of the largest blood donation centers, to discuss a shift in position and really focus on developing an individual risk-based assessment. Under these guidelines that the FDA has just announced, just to illustrate the absurdity of the policy, a person who has had unprotected sex only days before can donate blood. But a gay or bisexual man who has sex with another man within 3 months of the date of donation cannot, even if that man uses condoms or is taking HIV prevention medication such as PrEP. So as opposed to focusing on risk factors, which is what the FDA should be doing, they are instead focused on identity. And as I mentioned before, there are many countries around the globe that do not have deferral periods. We should be really focused on science And we are pushing the FDA. We're engaging with other blood donation centers to really rethink this policy because it's really unfair, it's illogical, and it's discriminatory.
Do you think this is potentially an inflection point where regulators could say, wait a minute, maybe we really should change this policy going forward?
That's what we're hoping. We're hoping that the regulators can take a step back and recognize that the policy was really rooted in fear and bias when it was implemented in 1983, recognizing that there were no scientific tests to really determine how they could track the virus. And people were living in a state of fear. So they implemented this policy, but we are imploring them to take a step back and recognize that the underlying rationale that supports the policy is outdated. And we're hoping that this is an inflection point, that they are going to be able to take a step back and look at the policy and reform it and really focus on risk factors.
Alfonso David is the president of the Human Rights Campaign, and James West is the deputy digital editor of Mother Jones Magazine. In the middle of a global health pandemic, it's hard not to feel anxious about the state of the world. But for comedian Aparna Nancherla, that overwhelming sense of anxiety isn't exactly new.
Yeah, I am someone who has a lot of anxiety, and it is weird that anxiety is finally on message. Like, if you're an anxious person, it's kind of like, well, you know, this is what we trained for. Like, this is our Olympics. It's like all those nights awake, like, it's showtime, you know? All the scenarios at once.
That was Aparna in a clip from her 2018 Netflix stand-up special. For the past several weeks, The Takeaway has been checking in with different comedians to see how they're adapting to social distancing for our series, Joking from a Distance. Today, we're happy to welcome Aparna Nancherla back to the show. Hello, how are you?
Hi, I'm great. How are you?
So, if 2018 was the Anxiety Olympics, where are we now?
I would say we're maybe it's, I mean, I think that was right after the 2016 election when I wrote that joke. So I think we're coming up on the next Olympics 4 years later.
You tweeted back on March 17th, "It turns out I've been social distancing my whole life." If you're someone who's always been uncomfortable with some social interactions, what has social distancing actually been like for you?
I mean, I don't know if I'm in the minority of introverts, but I feel like on some level, I mean, I'm in a fortunate position where, you know, no one in my household has been sick and I haven't had to go out a lot. So in a lot of ways, I feel like as an introvert, I've been living my best life, best introvert life.
You're clearly...
maximizing on all the things I've daydreamed about for many years.
You're clearly maximizing that, but I guess I'm wondering, you know, while making comedy, is it hard at all to manage your mental health while you're sort of holed up alone?
I think, yeah, it kind of goes through ups and downs. The first week or two of quarantine, I really felt like I was like, this is great. I could do this forever. And then I feel like maybe week three, I started to hit some more walls. I've still been doing therapy over the phone or over FaceTime, which has been pretty vital to, I think, balancing my brain. But it also is kind of oddly fascinating to see what my therapist's apartment looks like.
If there are people listening right now who are anxious or who lie awake in the middle of the night, do you have any advice for them?
Yeah, I mean, I've been kind of cycling through all the things I try when I'm anxious, like meditate. I actually haven't gone for walks, though I would recommend it if you have the ability. My boyfriend and I live in a neighborhood which has been, I don't know, I think in protest against quarantine in general. So we've been a little bit scared to go outside because it seems like everyone outside our apartment is a little bit living in an alternate reality where there is no pandemic.
Really? So they're out and about?
Well, it's gotten better. I've seen more masks now, but there's still definitely a group of people maybe conscientiously objecting to all the measures being taken.
You have been tweeting jokes. basically, since you started staying at home, how do you find humor right now?
It's tough. I mean, my humor has always been based in the day-to-day and mundane things. So I think I've been focusing on micro events rather than macro events for the most part. I've had to regulate my own intake of social media and the news. I don't know if it's ever healthy to take those in large amounts, but especially right now, even a little bit or a small thing can kind of send my day reeling, and then I don't have the same freedom of things I can do to counteract that. So I kind of have to be extra sensitive about those two things.
How do you work on new material? I mean, so many comedians like to workshop that in front of a crowd.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm in the lucky boat of not missing crowds as much. I mean, I think I'm one of those strange comedians who resents that I have to go stand in front of a crowd. So not that I really enjoy performing over Zoom. Like, I think it's a necessary evil of live performance to just be around large groups of people. But I think for me, it's been more focusing on just working on writing new things and focusing on the future of when maybe we'll be out and about again and able to workshop in front of crowds. But I haven't really been flexing that muscle as much as I think other comedians have of doing a lot of performance over the internet. I'm working on a book right now, so that's been kind of taking up the lion's share of my time.
And I guess that takes you away from the sort of like weird, awkward silence where the timing might not land if there's like a brief moment of digital buffering.
Right. And I feel like usually that time would be filled by my mental demons anyway, critiquing what I'm doing. So I kind of just have to fill that in even more with them.
You do host a weekly comedy show in Brooklyn, though, mm-hmm. called Butter Boy, and you've done some of that over Zoom. What's that been like?
I have to say it's been kind of a high point of my week just because I co-host it with two friends, Maeve Higgins and Joe Firestone, who are two also both very funny comedians. And I think it's a nice point of the week just to check in and have a semblance of normalcy of just, you know, hanging out with two friends and joking around with them and then having on guests who we all are eager to see what they do with their 5 minutes of internet time.
You know, you've performed at a lot of different places in New York City. Do you worry at all, particularly about small venues? Even after social distancing rules are relaxed, you know, people's nervousness to be in a crowd?
I do. I mean, it's strange because after the election, I think comedians are also worried about whether people would be in the mood to see a show, and it felt like it went the other way, where it felt like comedy shows were fuller than ever and continued to be for well into right before quarantine started. But now I think it might just be a strange, staggered march back into whatever normal looks like after this. But there definitely is going to be a shift, I think, in terms of any activities that involve congregating or groups. I think, I don't know, comedy in a way is kind of like cockroaches to me, in that it will withstand anything. Like, some version of it will rear its head. It felt like people were starting their Zoom shows as soon as they were told they couldn't go outside. So I think people will find a way, but I just don't, like many people, I don't know exactly what even tomorrow will look like as of now.
Aparna Nancherla is a comedian. Thank you so much, Aparna.
Thank you.
All right, people, that's another Monday in the books. And yes, we promise it is, in fact, Monday. Good to have you with us. And if you missed anything or you want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast. Subscribe and leave a rating while you're there. Helps other people find us. All of our COVID-19 coverage is up at thetakeaway.org/coronavirus. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway on Twitter, and I'm at Lizzie O'Reilly. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is The Takeaway. Talk to you tomorrow.